be doing serious damage to your internal apparatus. Say your rosary, Francis, and pray for your internal apparatus. Mam visits me on Thursdays. I'd like to see my father too, but I'm out of danger, crisis time is over, and I'm allowed only one visitor. Besides, she says, he's back at work at Rank's flour mills, and please God this job will last a while with the war on and the English desperate for flour. She brings me a chocolate bar, and that proves Dad is working. She could never afford it on the dole. He sends me notes. He tells me my brothers are all praying for me, that I should be a good boy, obey the doctors, the nuns, the nurses, and don't forget to say my prayers. He's sure St. Jude pulled me through the crisis because he's the patron saint of desperate cases, and I was indeed a desperate case. Patricia says she has two books by her bed. One is a poetry book, and that's the one she loves. The other is a short history of England, and do I want it? She gives it to Seamus, the man who mops the floor every day, and he brings it to me. He says, I'm not supposed to be bringing anything from a diphtheria room to a typhoid room with all the germs flying around and hiding between the pages. And if you ever catch diphtheria on top of the typhoid, they'll know, and I'll lose my good job and be out in the street singing patriotic songs with a tin cup in my hand. Which I could easily do, because there isn't a song ever written about Ireland's sufferings I don't know. And a few songs about the joys of whiskey, too. Oh, yes, he knows Roddy McCauley. He'll sing it for me right enough. But he's barely into the first verse when the Kerry nurse rushes in. What's this, Seamus? Singing? Of all the people in this hospital, you should know the rules against singing. I have a good mind to report you to Sister Rita. Ah, God, don't do that, nurse. Very well, Seamus. I let it go this one time. You know the singing could lead to a relapse in these patients. When she leaves, he whispers he'll teach me a few songs because singing is good for passing the time when you're by yourself in a typhoid room. He says Patricia is a lovely girl, the way she often gives him sweets from the parcel her mother sends every fortnight. He stops mopping the floor and calls to Patricia in the next room. I was telling Frankie you're a lovely girl, Patricia. And she says, you're a lovely man, Seamus. He smiles because he's an old man of 40. And he never had children but the ones he can talk to here in the fever hospital. He says, here's the book, Frankie. Isn't it a great pity you have to be reading all about England after all they did to us? That there isn't a history of Ireland to be had in this hospital. The book tells me all about King Alfred and William the Conqueror and all the kings and queens down to Edward, who had to wait forever for his mother, Victoria, to die before he could be king. The book has the first bit of Shakespeare I ever read. I do believe, induced by potent circumstances, that thou art mine enemy. The history writer says, this is what Catherine, who is a wife of Henry VIII, says to Cardinal Wolsey, who's trying to have her head cut off. I don't know what it means, and I don't care, because it's Shakespeare, and it's like having jewels in my mouth when I say the words. If I had a whole book of Shakespeare, they could keep me in the hospital for a year. Patricia says she doesn't know what induce means or potent circumstances, and she doesn't care about Shakespeare. She has her poetry book, and she reads to me from beyond the wall a poem about an owl and a pussycat that went to sea in a green boat with honey and money. And it makes no sense. And when I say that, Patricia gets huffy and says that's the last poem she'll ever read to me. She says I'm always reciting the lines from Shakespeare, and they make no sense either. Seamus stops mopping again and tells us we shouldn't be fighting over poetry because we'll have enough to fight about when we grow up and get married. Patricia says she's sorry, and I'm sorry too. So she reads me part of another poem, which I have to remember, so I can say it back to her early in the morning or late at night when there are no nuns or nurses about. The wind was a torrent of darkness among the gusty trees. The moon was a ghostly galleon tossed upon cloudy seas. The road was a ribbon of moonlight over the purple moor, and the highwayman came riding, 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 the highwayman came riding up to the old inn door. He'd a French cocked hat on his forehead, a bunch of lace at his chin, a coat of the claret velvet, and breeches of brown doe skin. They fitted with never a wrinkle, his boots were up to the thigh, and he rode with a jewel twinkle, his pistol butts a twinkle, his rapier hilt a twinkle, under the jeweled sky. Every day I can't wait for the doctors and nurses to leave me alone, so I can learn a new verse from Patricia, and find out what's happening to the highwayman and the landlord's red-lipped daughter. I love the poem because it's exciting and almost as good as my two lines of Shakespeare. The redcoats are after the highwayman because they know he told her, I'll come to thee by moonlight, though hell should bar the way. I'd love to do that myself. Come by moonlight for Patricia in the next room, not giving a fiddler's fart, though hell should bar the way. She's ready to read the last few verses, when in comes the nurse from Kerry, shouting at her, shouting at me. I told ye there was to be no talking between rooms. Diphtheria is never allowed to talk to typhoid, and vice versa. I warned ye. And she calls out, Seamus, take this one. Take the bye. Sister Rita said one more word out of him and upstairs with him. We gave ye a warning to stop the blathering, but ye wouldn't. Take the bye, Seamus. Take him. And now, nurse. Sure isn't he harmless? 'Tis only a bit of poetry. Take that bye, Seamus. Take him at once. He bends over me and whispers, Ah, God, I'm sorry, Frankie. Here's your English history book. He slips the book under my shirt and lifts me from the bed. He whispers that I'm a feather. I tried to see Patricia when we passed through her room, but all I can make out is a blur of dark head on the pillow. Sister Rita stops us in the hall to tell me I'm a great disappointment to her, that she expected me to be a good boy after what God had done for me, after all the prayers said by hundreds of boys at the confraternity, after all the care from the nuns and nurses of the fever hospital, after the way they let my mother and father in to see me, a thing rarely allowed, and this is how I repay them, lying in the bed reciting silly poetry back and forth with Patricia Madigan, knowing very well there was a ban on all talk between typhoid and diphtheria. She says I'll have plenty of time to reflect on my sins in the big ward upstairs, and I should beg God's forgiveness for my disobedience, reciting a pagan English poem about a thief and a horse and a maiden with red lips who commits a terrible sin, when I could have been praying or reading the life of a saint. She made it her business to read that poem, so she did, and I'd be well advised to tell the priest in confession. The Kerry nurse follows us upstairs, gasping and holding onto the banister. She tells me I better not get the notion she'll be running up to this part of the world every time I have a little pain or a twinge. There are 20 beds in the ward, all white, all empty. The nurse tells Seamus put me at the far end of the ward against the wall to make sure I don't talk to anyone who might be passing the door, which is very unlikely, since there isn't another soul in this whole floor. She tells Seamus this was the fever ward during the great famine long ago, and only God knows how many died here, brought in too late for anything but a wash before they were buried, and there are stories of cries and moans in the far reaches of the night. She says 'twould break your heart to think of what the English did to us, that if they didn't put the blight on the potato, they didn't do much to take it off. No pity. No feeling at all for the people that died in this very ward. Children suffering and dying here while the English feasted on roast beef and guzzled the best of wine in their big houses. Little children with their mouths all green from trying to eat the grass in the fields beyond, God bless us and save us and guard us from future famines. Seamus says, 'twas a terrible thing indeed, and he wouldn't want to be walking these halls in the dark, with all the little green mouths gaping at him. The nurse takes my temperature. 'Tis up a bit. Have a good sleep for yourself, now that you're away from the chatter with Patricia Madigan below, who will never know a grey hair.' She shakes her head at Seamus, and he gives her a sad shake back. Nurses and nuns never think you know what they're talking about. If you're 10 going on 11, you're supposed to be simple like my Uncle Pat Sheehan, who was dropped in his head. You can't ask questions. You can't show you understand what the nurse said about Patricia Madigan, that she's going to die. And you can't show you want to cry over this girl who taught you a lovely poem which the nun says is bad. The nurse tells Seamus she has to go, and he's to sweep the lint from under my bed and mop up a bit around the ward. Seamus tells me she's a right old bitch for running to Sister Rita and complaining about the poem going between the two rooms, that you can't catch a disease from a poem unless it's love, ha ha, and that's not bloody likely when you're what, 10, going on 11? He never heard the likes of it. A little fella shifted upstairs for saying a poem, and he has a good mind to go to the Limerick Leader and tell them print the whole thing, except he has this job and he'd lose it if ever Sister Rita found out. Anyway, Frankie, you'll be out of here one of these fine days, and you can read all the poetry you want, though I don't know about Patricia below. I don't know about Patricia. God help us. He knows about Patricia in 2 days, because she got out of the bed to go to the lavatory when she was supposed to use a bedpan, and collapsed, and died in the lavatory. Seamus is mopping the floor, and there are tears on his cheeks, and he's saying, 'Tis a dirty, rotten thing to die in a lavatory when you're lovely in yourself. She told me she was sorry she had you reciting that poem and getting you shifted from the room, Frankie. She said 'twas all her fault. It wasn't, Seamus. I know, and didn't I tell her that? Patricia is gone, and I'll never know what happened to the highwayman and Bess, the landlord's daughter. I asked Seamus, but he doesn't know any poetry at all, especially English poetry. He knew an Irish poem once, but it was about fairies and had no sign of a highwayman in it. Still, he'll ask the men in his local pub, where there's always someone reciting something, and he'll bring it back to me. Won't I be busy meanwhile reading my short history of England and finding out all about their perfidy? That's what Seamus says, perfidy. And I don't know what it means, and he doesn't know what it means, but if it's something the English do, it must be terrible. He comes 3 times a week to mop the floor, and the nurse is there every morning to take my temperature and pulse. The doctor listens to my chest with the thing hanging from his neck. They all say, "And how is our little soldier today?" A girl with a blue dress brings meals 3 times a day and never talks to me. Seamus says, "She's not right in the head, so don't say a word to her." The July days are long, and I fear the dark. There are only 2 ceiling lights in the ward, and they're switched off when the tea tray is taken away and the nurse gives me pills. The nurse tells me go to sleep, but I can't because I see people in the 19 beds in the ward, all dying, and green around their mouths where they try to eat grass and moaning for soup, Protestant soup, any soup. And I cover my face with the pillow, hoping they won't come and stand around the bed, clawing at me and howling for bits of the chocolate bar my mother brought last week. No, she didn't bring it. She had to send it in because I can't have any more visitors. Sister Rita tells me a visit to the fever hospital is a privilege, and after my bad behaviour with Patricia Madigan and that poem, I can't have the privilege any more. She says I'll be going home in a few weeks, and my job is to concentrate on getting better and learn to walk again after being in bed for 6 weeks, and I can get out of bed tomorrow after breakfast. I don't know why she says I have to learn how to walk, when I've been walking since I was a baby. But when the nurse stands me by the side of the bed, I fall to the floor and the nurse laughs. See? You're a baby again. I practice walking from bed to bed, back and forth, back and forth. I don't want to be a baby. I don't want to be in this empty ward with no Patricia and no highwayman and no red-lipped landlord's daughter. I don't want the ghosts of children with green mouths pointing bony fingers at me and clamouring for bits of my chocolate bar. Seamus says a man in his pub knew all the verses of the highwayman poem, and it has a very sad end. Would I like him to say it? Because he never learned how to read, and he had to carry the poem in his head. He stands in the middle of the ward, leaning on his mop, and recites. Trot, trot in the frosty silence, trot, trot in the echoing night. Nearer he came and nearer, her face was like a light. Her eyes grew white for a moment, she drew one last deep breath. Then her finger moved in the moonlight, her musket shattered the moonlight, shattered her breast in the moonlight, and warned him with her death. He hears the shot and escapes, but when he learns at dawn how Bess died, he goes into a rage and returns for revenge, only to be shot down by the redcoats. Blood red were his spurs in the golden noon, wine red was his velvet coat, when they shot him down on the highway, down like a dog on the highway, and he lay in his blood on the highway with a bunch of lace at his throat. Seamus wipes his sleeve across his face and sniffles. He says, "There was no call at all to shift you up here away from Patricia when you didn't even know what happened to the highwayman and Bess. 'Tis a very sad story, and when I said it to my wife, she couldn't stop crying the whole night till we went to bed. She said there was no call for them redcoats to shoot that highwayman. They are responsible for half the troubles of the world, and they never had any pity on the Irish either. Now, if you want to know any more poems, Frankie, tell me, and I'll get them from the pub and bring them back in my head." The girl with the blue dress, who's not right in the head, suddenly says one day, "Would you like a book for to read?" And she brings me The Amazing Quest of Mr. Ernest Bliss by E. Phillips Oppenheim, which is all about an Englishman who is fed up and doesn't know what to do with himself every day, even though he's so rich he can't count his money. His manservant brings him the morning paper, the tea, the egg, the toast and marmalade, and he says, "Take it away. Life is empty." He can't read his paper, he can't eat his egg, and he pines away. His doctor tells him, "Go and live among the poor in the East End of London, and he'll learn to love life," which he does, and falls in love with a girl who is poor but honest and very intelligent. And they get married and move into his house in the West End, which is the rich part because it's easier to help the poor and not be fed up when you're nice and comfortable. Seamus likes me to tell him what I'm reading. He says, "That story about Mr. Ernest Bliss is a made-up story, because no one in his right mind would have to go to a doctor over having too much money and not eating his egg, though you never know. It might be like that in England. You'd never find the likes of that in Ireland. If you didn't eat your egg here, you'd be carted off to the lunatic asylum or reported to the bishop." I can't wait to go home and tell Malachy about this man who won't eat his egg. Malachy will fall down on the floor laughing, because such a thing could never happen. He'll say I'm making it up, but when I tell him this story is about an Englishman, he'll understand. I can't tell the girl in the blue dress that this story was silly, because she might have a fit. She says, "If you're finished with that book, I'll bring you another one, because there's a whole box of books left behind by patients from the old days." She brings me a book called Tom Brown's School Days, which is hard to read, and no end of books by P.G. Woodhouse, who makes me laugh over Euchridge and Bertie Wooster and Jeeves and all the Mulliners. Bertie Wooster is rich, but he eats his egg every morning for fear of what Jeeves might say. I wish I could talk to the girl in the blue dress or anyone about the books, but I'm afraid the Kerry nurse or Sister Rita might find out, and they'd move me to a bigger ward upstairs with 50 empty beds and famine ghosts galore with green mouths and bony fingers pointing. At night I lie in bed thinking about Tom Brown and his adventures at rugby school and all the characters in P.G. Woodhouse. I can dream about the red-lipped landlord's daughter and the highwaymen, and the nurses and nuns can do nothing about it. It's lovely to know the world can't interfere with the inside of your head. It's August, and I'm 11. I've been in this hospital for 2 months, and I wonder if they'll let me out for Christmas. The Kerry nurse tells me I should get down on my two knees and thank God I'm alive at all, and not be complaining. I'm not complaining, nurse. I'm only wondering if I'll be home for Christmas. She won't answer me. She tells me behave myself, or she'll send Sister Rita up to me, and then I'll behave myself. Ma'am comes to the hospital on my birthday and sends up a package with 2 chocolate bars and a note with names of people in the lane telling me get better and come home, and you're a great soldier, Frankie. The nurse lets me talk to her through the window, and it's hard because the windows are high, and I have to stand on Seamus's shoulders. I tell Ma'am I want to go home, but she says I'm a bit too weak, and surely I'll be out in no time. Seamus says, "Ah, 'tis a grand thing to be 11, because any day now you'll be a man shaving and all, and ready to get out and get a job, and drink your pint as good as any man." After 14 weeks, Sister Rita tells me I can go home. And aren't I a lucky boy that the day will be the feast of St. Francis of Assisi. She tells me I was a very good patient, except for that little problem with the poem of Patricia Madigan, God rest her. And I'm invited to come back and have a big Christmas dinner in the hospital. Ma'am comes for me, and with my weak legs, it takes us a long time to walk to the bus at Union Cross. She says, "Take your time. After 3.5 months, we can spare an hour." People are at their doors on Barrack Road and Roden Lane, telling me it's grand to see me back, that I'm a great soldier, a credit to my father and mother. Malachy and Michael run up to me in the lane and say, "God, you're walking very slow. Can't you run any more?" It's a bright day, and I'm happy, till I see Dad sitting in the kitchen with Alfie in his lap. And there's an empty feeling in my heart because I know he's out of work again. All along I was sure he had a job. Ma'am told me he did. And I thought there would be no shortage of food and shoes. He smiles at me and tells Alfie, "Ach, there's your big brother home from the hospital." Ma'am tells him what the doctor said, that I'm to have plenty of nourishing food and rest. The doctor said beef would be the right thing for building me up again. Dad nods. Ma'am makes beef tea from a cube, and Malachy and Mike watch me drink it. They say they'd like some too, but Ma'am says, "Go away, you didn't have the typhoid." She says the doctor wants me to go to bed early. She tried to get rid of the fleas, but they're worse than ever with the warm weather we're having. "Besides," she says, "they won't get much out of you, all bones and little skin." I lie in bed and think of the hospital where the white sheets were changed every day, and there wasn't a sign of a flea. There was a lavatory where you could sit and read your book till someone asked if you were dead. There was a bath where you could sit in hot water as long as you liked and say, "I do believe, induced by potent circumstances, that thou art mine enemy." And saying that helps me fall asleep. When Malachy and Michael get up for school in the morning, Ma'am tells me I can stay in bed. Malachy is in 5th class now with Mr. O'Dea, and he likes to tell everyone he's learning the big red catechism for confirmation, and Mr. O'Dea is telling them all about State of Grace and Euclid and how the English tormented the Irish for 800 long years. I don't want to stay in bed anymore. The October days are lovely, and I want to sit outside, looking up the lane, at the way the sun slants on the wall opposite our house. Mikey Maloney brings me P.G. Woodhouse books his father gets from the library, and I have great days with Euchridge and Bertie Wooster and all the Mulliners. Dad lets me read his favourite book, John Mitchell's Jail Journal, which is all about a great Irish rebel the English condemned to exile in Van Diemen's Land in Australia. The English tell John Mitchell he's free to come and go as he pleases all over Van Diemen's Land. If he gives his word of honour as a gentleman, he won't try to escape. He gives his word till a ship comes to help him escape, and he goes to the office of the English magistrate and says, "I'm escaping," jumps on his horse and winds up in New York. Dad says he doesn't mind if I read silly English books by P.G. Woodhouse, as long as I don't forget the men who did their bit and gave their lives for Ireland. I can't stay at home forever, and Mam takes me back to Leamy School in November. The new headmaster, Mr. O'Halloran, says he's sorry, I've missed over 2 months of school, and I have to be put back into fifth class. Mam says, "Surely I'm ready for sixth class. After all," she says, "he's missed only a few weeks." Mr. O'Halloran says, "He's sorry, take the boy next door to Mr. O'Dea." We walk along the hallway and I tell Mam I don't want to be in fifth class. Malachy is in that class and I don't want to be in a class with my brother who's a year younger. I made my confirmation last year, he didn't. I'm older. I'm not bigger anymore because of the typhoid, but I'm older. Mam says, "It won't kill you." She doesn't care. And I'm put into that class with Malachy, and I know all his friends are there sneering at me because I was put back. Mr. O'Dea makes me sit in the front and tells me get that sour look off my puss or I'll feel the end of his ash plant. Then a miracle happens, and it's all because of St. Francis of Assisi, my favourite saint, and Our Lord himself. I find a penny in the street that first day back at school, and I want to run to Kathleen O'Connell's for a big square of Cleve's toffee, but I can't run because my legs are still weak from the typhoid, and sometimes I have to hold on to a wall. I'm desperate for the Cleve's toffee, but I'm also desperate to get out of fifth class. I know I have to go to the statue of St. Francis of Assisi. He's the only one who will listen, but he's at the other end of Limerick, and it takes me an hour to walk there, sitting on steps, holding onto walls. It's a penny to light a candle, and I wonder if I should just light the candle and keep the penny. No, St. Francis would know. He loves the bird in the air and the fish in the stream, but he's not a fool. I light the candle. I kneel at his statue and beg him to get me out of fifth class where I'm stuck with my brother, who's probably going around the lane now, bragging that his big brother was kept back. St. Francis doesn't say a word, but I know he's listening, and I know he'll get me out of that class. It's the least he could do after all my trouble coming to his statue, sitting on steps, holding onto walls, when I could have gone to St. Joseph's Church and lit a candle to the little flower, or the Sacred Heart of Jesus himself. What's the use of being named after him if he's going to desert me in my hour of need? I have to sit in Mr. O'Dea's class, listening to the catechism and all the other stuff he taught last year. I'd like to raise my hand and give the answers, but he says, "Be quiet. Let your brother answer." He gives them tests in arithmetic and makes me sit there and correct them. He dictates to them in Irish and makes me correct what they've written. Then he gives me special compositions to write and makes me read them to the class because of all I learned from him last year. He tells the class, "Frank McCourt is going to show you how well he learned to write in this class last year. He's going to write a composition on Our Lord, aren't you, McCourt? He's going to tell us what it would be like if Our Lord had grown up in Limerick, which has the arch-confraternity of the Holy Family and is the holiest city in Ireland. We know that if Our Lord had grown up in Limerick, he would never have been crucified, because the people of Limerick were always good Catholics and not given to crucifixion. So, McCourt, you are to go home and write that composition and bring it in tomorrow." Dad says Mr. O'Dea has a great imagination. But didn't Our Lord suffer enough on the cross without sticking him in Limerick on top of it with the damp from the River Shannon? He puts on his cap and goes for a long walk, and I have to think about Our Lord by myself and wonder what I'm going to write tomorrow. The next day, Mr. O'Dea says, "All right, McCourt, read your composition to the class."
"The name of my composition is..."
"The title, McCourt, the title."
"The title of my composition is Jesus and the Weather."
"What?"
"Jesus and the Weather."
"All right, read it."
"This is my composition. I don't think Jesus, who is our Lord, would have liked the weather in Limerick because it's always raining and the Shannon keeps the whole city damp. My father says the Shannon is a killer river because it killed my two brothers. When you look at pictures of Jesus, he's always wandering around ancient Israel in a sheet. It never rains there, and you never hear of anyone coughing or getting consumption or anything like that. And no one has a job there because all they do is stand around and eat manna and shake their fists and go to crucifixions. Anytime Jesus got hungry, all he had to do was walk up the road to a fig tree or an orange tree and have his fill. If he wanted a pint, he could wave his hand over a big glass and there was the pint. Or he could visit Mary Magdalene and her sister Martha, and they'd give him his dinner no questions asked, and he'd get his feet washed and dried with Mary Magdalene's hair while Martha washed the dishes, which I don't think is fair. Why should she have to wash the dishes while her sister sits out there chatting away with our Lord? It's a good thing Jesus decided to be born Jewish in that warm place, because if he was born in Limerick, he'd catch the consumption and be dead in a month, and there wouldn't be any Catholic Church, and there wouldn't be any communion or confirmation, and we wouldn't have to learn the catechism and write compositions about him. The end. Mr. O'Dea is quiet and gives me a strange look, and I'm worried because when he's quiet like that, it means someone's going to suffer.
He says, "McCourt, who wrote that composition?"
"I did, sir."
"Did your father write that composition?"
"He didn't, sir."
"Come here, McCourt." I follow him out the door, along the hall, to the headmaster's room. Mr. O'Dea shows him my composition, and Mr. O'Halloran gives me the strange look, too.
"Did you write this composition?"
"I did, sir." I'm taken out of the fifth class and put into Mr. O'Halloran's sixth class with all the boys I know, Petty Clossy, Fintan Slattery, the Question Quigley, and when school is over that day, I have to go back down to the statue of St. Francis of Assisi to thank him, even if my legs are still weak from the typhoid and I have to sit on steps and hold on to walls. And I wonder, was it something good I said in that composition? Or something bad? Mr. Thomas L. O'Halloran teaches three classes in one room, 6th, 7th, 8th. He has a head like President Roosevelt, and he wears gold glasses. He wears suits, navy blue or grey, and there's a gold watch chain that hangs across his belly from pocket to pocket in his waistcoat. We call him Hoppy because he has a short leg and hops when he walks. He knows what we call him, and he says,
"Yes, I'm Hoppy, and I'll hop on you."
He carries a long stick, a pointer, and if you don't pay attention or give a stupid answer, he gives you three slaps on each hand or whacks you across the backs of your legs. He makes you learn everything by heart, everything, and that makes him the hardest master in the school. He loves America and makes us know all the American states in alphabetical order. He makes charts of Irish grammar, Irish history, and algebra at home, hangs them on an easel, and we have to chant our way through the cases, conjugations, and declensions of Irish, famous names and battles, proportions, ratios, equations. We have to know all the important dates in Irish history. He tells us what is important and why. No master ever told us why before. If you ask why, you'd be hit in the head. Hoppy doesn't call us idiots, and if you ask a question, he doesn't go into a rage. He's the only master who stops and says, "Do ye understand what I'm talking about? Do ye want to ask a question?" It's a shock to everyone when he says, "The Battle of Kinsale in 1601 was the saddest moment in Irish history, a close battle with cruelty and atrocities on both sides."
Cruelty on both sides?
The Irish side? How could that be? All the other masters told us the Irish always fought nobly. They always fought the fair fight.
He recites and makes us remember. They went forth to battle, but they always fell. Their eyes were fixed above the sullen shields. Nobly they fought and bravely, but not well, and sank heart-wounded by a subtle spell. If they lost, it was because of traitors and informers. But I want to know about these Irish atrocities.
Sir, did the Irish commit atrocities at the Battle of Kinsale?
They did indeed. It is recorded that they killed prisoners, but they were no better nor worse than the English. Mr. O'Halloran can't lie. He's the headmaster. All these years we were told the Irish were always noble and they made brave speeches before the English hanged them. Now Hoppy O'Halloran is saying the Irish did bad things. Next thing he'll be saying the English did good things. He says, "You have to study and learn so that you can make up your own mind about history and everything else, but you can't make up an empty mind. Stock your mind. Stock your mind. It is your house of treasure, and no one in the world can interfere with it. If you won the Irish sweepstakes and bought a house that needed furniture, would you fill it with bits and pieces of rubbish? Your mind is your house, and if you fill it with rubbish from the cinemas, it will rot in your head. You might be poor, your shoes might be broken, but your mind is a palace." He calls us one by one to the front of the room and looks at our shoes. He wants to know why they're broken or why we have no shoes at all. He tells us, "This is a disgrace," and he's going to have a raffle to raise money so that we can have strong, warm boots for the winter. He gives us books of tickets, and we swarm all over Limerick for Leamy School Boot Fund. First prize, £5. Five prizes of a pound each. 11 boys with no boots get new boots. Malachy and I don't get any because we have shoes on our feet, even if the soles are worn away, and we wonder why we ran all over Limerick selling tickets so that other boys could get boots. Fintan Slattery says we gain plenary indulgences for works of charity, and Paddy Clossy says, "Fintan, would you ever go and have a good shit for yourself?" I know when Dad does the bad thing. I know when he drinks the dole money and Mam is desperate and has to beg at the St. Vincent de Paul Society and ask for credit at Kathleen O'Connell's shop. But I don't want to back away from him and run to Mam. How can I do that when I'm up with him early every morning with the whole world asleep? He lights the fire and makes the tea and sings to himself or reads the paper to me in a whisper that won't wake up the rest of the family. Mikey Malloy stole Cahoolan. The angel on the seventh step is gone someplace else, but my father in the morning is still mine. He gets the Irish press early and tells me about the world, Hitler, Mussolini, Franco. He says this war is none of our business because the English are up to their tricks again. He tells me about the great Roosevelt in Washington and the great De Valera in Dublin. In the morning we have the world to ourselves, and he never tells me I should die for Ireland. He tells me about the old days in Ireland when the English wouldn't let the Catholics have schools because they wanted to keep the people ignorant, that the Catholic children met in hedge schools in the depths of the country and learned English, Irish, Latin and Greek. The people love learning. They love stories and poetry, even if none of this was any good for getting a job. Men, women and children would gather in ditches to hear those great masters, and everyone wondered at how much a man could carry in his head. The masters risked their lives going from ditch to ditch and hedge to hedge, because if the English caught them teaching, they might be transported to foreign parts or worse. He tells me school is easy now. You don't have to sit in a ditch learning your sums or the glorious history of Ireland. I should be good in school, and someday I'll go back to America and get an inside job where I'll be sitting at a desk with two fountain pens in my pocket, one red and one blue, making decisions.
I'll be in out of the rain, and I'll have a suit and shoes and a warm place to live. And what more could a man want? He says you can do anything in America. It's the land of opportunity. You could be a fisherman in Maine or a farmer in California. America is not like Limerick, a great place with a river that kills. When you have your father to yourself by the fire in the morning, you don't need Cuchulainn or the angel on the seventh step or anything. At night he helps us with our exercises. Mam says they call it homework in America, but here it's exercises, the sums, the English, the Irish, the history. He can't help us with Irish because he's from the north and lacking in the native tongue. Malachy offers to teach him all the Irish words he knows, but Dad says it's too late. You can't teach an old dog a new bark. Before bed we sit around the fire, and if we say, Dad, tell us a story, he makes up one about someone in the lane, and the story will take us all over the world, up in the air, under the sea, and back to the lane. Everyone in the story is a different colour, and everything is upside down and backward. Motor cars and planes go underwater, and submarines fly through the sky. Sharks sit in trees, and giant salmon sport with kangaroos on the moon. Polar bears wrestle with elephants in Australia, and penguins teach Zulus how to play bagpipes. After the story, he takes us upstairs and kneels with us while we say our prayers. We say the Our Father, three Hail Marys, God bless the Pope, God bless Mam, God bless our dead sister and brothers, God bless Ireland, God bless De Valera, and God bless anyone who gives Dad a job. He says, go to sleep, boys, because Holy God is watching you, and he always knows if you're not good. I think my father is like the Holy Trinity, with three people in him. The one in the morning, with the paper. The one at night, with the stories and the prayers. And then, the one who does the bad thing and comes home with the smell of whiskey, and wants us to die for Ireland. I feel sad over the bad thing, but I can't back away from him because the one in the morning is my real father. And if I were in America, I could say, I love you, Dad, the way they do in the films. But you can't say that in Limerick for fear you might be laughed at. You're allowed to say you love God and babies and horses that win. But anything else is a softness in the head. Day and night we're tormented in that kitchen with people emptying their buckets. Mam says it's not the River Shannon that will kill us, but the stink from that lavatory outside our door. It's bad enough in the winter when everything flows over and seeps under our door, but worse in the warm weather when there are flies and blue bottles and rats. There's a stable next door to the lavatory where they keep the big horse from Gabbett's coal yard. His name is Finn the Horse, and we all love him. But the stable man from the coal yard doesn't take proper care of the stable, and the stink travels to our house. The stink from the lavatory in the stable attracts rats, and we have to chase them with our new dog, Lucky. He loves to corner the rats, and then we smash them to bits with rocks or sticks, or stab them with the hay fork in the stable. The horse himself is frightened by the rats, and we have to be careful when he rears up. He knows we're not rats, because we bring him apples when we rob an orchard out the country. Sometimes the rats escape and run into our house and into the coal hole under the stairs where it's pitch dark and you can't see them. Even when we bring in a candle, we can't find them because they dig holes everywhere and we don't know where to look. If we have a fire, we can boil water and pour it slowly in from the kettle spout, and that will drive them out of the hole between our legs and out the door again, unless Lucky is there to catch them in his teeth and shake the life out of them. We expect him to eat the rats, but he'll leave them in the lane with their guts hanging out and run to my father for a piece of bread dipped in tea. People in the lane say, that's a peculiar way for a dog to behave, but then what would you expect from a dog of the McCourts? The minute there's a sign of a rat, or a mention of one, Mam is out the door and up the lane. She'd rather walk the streets of Limerick forever than stay 1 minute in a house that has a rat in it. And she can never rest, because she knows that with the stable and the lavatory, there's always a rat nearby with his family waiting for their dinner. We fight the rats, and we fight the stink from that lavatory. We'd like to keep our door open in the warm weather, but you can't when people are trotting down the lane to empty their brimming buckets. Some families are worse than others, and Dad hates all of them, even though Mam tells him it's not their fault if the builders 100 years ago put up houses with no lavatories but this one outside our door. Dad says the people should empty their buckets in the middle of the night when we're asleep, so that we won't be disturbed by the stink. The flies are nearly as bad as the rats. On warm days they swarm to the stable, and when a bucket is emptied, they swarm to the lavatory. If Mam cooks anything, they swarm into the kitchen, and Dad says it's disgusting to think the fly sitting there in the sugar bowl was on the toilet bowl, or what's left of it, a minute ago. If you have an open sore, they find it and torment you. By day you have the flies, by night you have the fleas. Mam says there's one good thing about fleas, they're clean. But flies are filthy. You'll never know where they came from, and they carry diseases galore. We can chase the rats and kill them. We can slap at the flies and the fleas and kill them. But there's nothing we can do about the neighbours and their buckets. If we're out in the lane playing, and we see someone with a bucket, we call to our own house, "Bucket coming, close the door, close the door." And whoever is inside runs to the door. In warm weather we run to close the door all day because we know which families have the worst buckets. There are families whose fathers have jobs, and if they get into the habit of cooking with curry, we know their buckets will stink to the heavens and make us sick. Now with the war on, and men sending money from England, more and more families are cooking with curry, and our houses fill with the stink day and night. We know the families with the curry, we know the ones with the cabbage. Mam is sick all the time, Dad takes longer and longer walks into the country, and we play outside as much as we can, and far from the lavatory. Dad doesn't complain about the River Shannon anymore. He knows now the lavatory is worse, and he takes me with him to the town hall to complain. The man says, "Mister, all I can tell you is, you can move." Dad says we can't afford to move, and the man says there's nothing he can do. Dad says, "This is not India. This is a Christian country. The lane needs more lavatories." The man says, "Do you expect Limerick to start building lavatories in houses that are falling down anyway, that will be demolished after the war?" Dad says that lavatory could kill us all. The man says, "We live in dangerous times." Mam says it's hard enough keeping a fire going to cook the Christmas dinner, but if I am going to Christmas dinner at the hospital, I'll have to wash myself from top to bottom. She wouldn't give it to Sister Rita to say I was neglected or ripe for another disease. She boils a pot of water early in the morning before Mass and nearly scalds the scalp off me. She scours my ears and scrubs my skin so hard it tingles. She can afford tuppence for the bus out to the hospital, but I'll have to walk back, and that'll be good for me because I'll be stuffed with food. And now she has to get the fire going again for the pig's head and cabbage and floury white potatoes, which she got once again through the kindness of the St. Vincent de Paul Society. And she's determined this will be the last time we celebrate the birth of our Lord with pig's head. Next year we'll have a goose or a nice ham, and why wouldn't we? Isn't Limerick famous the world over for the ham? Sister Rita says, "Now would you look at this. Our little soldier looking so healthy. No meat on the bones, but still. Now tell me, did you go to Mass this morning?" "I did, sister." "And did you receive?" "I did, sister." She takes me into an empty ward and tells me sit there on that chair. It won't be long now till I get my dinner. She leaves, and I wonder if I'll be eating with nuns and nurses. Or will I be in a ward with children having their Christmas dinner? In a while, my dinner is brought in by the girl in the blue dress who brought me the books. She places the tray on the side of a bed, and I pull up a chair. She frowns at me and screws up her face. "You," she says, "that's your dinner, and I'm not bringing you any books." The dinner is delicious. Turkey, mashed potatoes, peas, jelly and custard, and a pot of tea. The jelly and custard dish looks delicious, and I can't resist it, so I'll have it first. There's no one there to notice. But when I'm eating it, the girl in the blue dress comes in with the bread and says,
"What are you doing?"
"Nothing."
"Yes, you are. You're eating the sweet before the dinner."
And she runs out calling,
"Sister Rita, Sister Rita, come in quick."
And the nun rushes in.
"Francis, are you all right?"
"I am, sister."
"He's not all right, sister. He do be eating his jelly and custard before his dinner. That's a sin, sister."
"Ah, now, dear, you run along, and I'll talk to Francis about that."
"Do, sister. Talk to him, or all the children in the hospital will be eating the sweet before their dinner, and then where will we be?"
"Indeed, indeed, where will we be? Run along now." The girl leaves, and Sister Rita smiles at me. God love her, she doesn't miss a thing, even in her confusion. We have to be patient with her, Francis, the way she's touched. She leaves, and it's quiet in that empty ward. And when I'm finished, I don't know what to do, because you're not supposed to do anything till they tell you. Hospitals and schools always tell you what to do. I wait a long time till the girl in the blue dress comes in for the tray.
"Are you finished?"
she says.
"I am."
"Well, that's all you're getting now, and you can go home."
Surely girls who are not right in the head can't tell you go home. And I wonder if I should wait for Sister Rita. A nurse in the hallway tells me Sister Rita is having her dinner and is not to be bothered. It's a long walk from Union Cross to Barrack Hill. When I get home, my family are up in Italy and well into their pig's head and cabbage and floury white potatoes. I tell them about my Christmas dinner. Mam wants to know if I had it with the nurses and nuns, and she gets a bit angry when I tell her I ate alone in a ward, and that's no way to treat a child. She tells me, "Sit down and have some pig's head," and I force it into my mouth, and I'm so stuffed I have to lie in the bed with my belly sticking out a mile. It's early in the morning, and there's a motor car outside our door, the first one we've ever seen in the lane. There are men in suits looking in the door of the stable of Finn the Horse, and there must be something wrong, because you never see men with suits in the lane. It's Finn the Horse. He's lying on the floor of the stable, looking up the lane, and there's white stuff like milk around his mouth. The stableman who takes care of Finn the Horse says he found him like that this morning, and it's strange because he's always up and ready for his feed. The men are shaking their heads. My brother Michael says to one of the men,
"Mister, what's up with Finn?"
"Sick horse, son. Go home." The stableman who takes care of Finn has the whiskey smell on him. He says to Michael,
"That horse is a goner. We have to shoot him."
Michael pulls at my hand.
"Frank, they're not to shoot him. Tell them, you're big."
The stableman says, "Go home, boy, go home." Michael attacks him, kicks him, scrubs the back of his hand, and the man sends Michael flying.
"Hold that brother of yours," he tells me. "Hold him."
One of the other men takes something yellow and brown from a bag, goes to Finn, puts it to his head, and there's a sharp crack. Finn shivers. Michael screams at the man and attacks him too, but the man says, "The horse was sick, son. He's better off." The men in suits drive away, and the stableman says he has to wait for the lorry to take Finn away. He can't leave him alone or the rats will be at him. He wants to know if we'd keep an eye on the horse with our dog Lucky while he goes to the pub. He's blue mouldy for a pint. No rat has a chance to get near Finn the horse, the way Michael is there with the stick, small as he is. The man comes back, smelling a porter. And then there's the big lorry to take the horse away, a big lorry with three men and two great planks that slope from the back of the lorry to Finn's head. The three men and the stableman tie ropes around Finn and pull him up the planks. And the people in the lane yell at the men because of the nails and broken wood in the planks that catch at Finn and tear out bits of his hide and streak the planks with bright pink horse blood.
"Ye are destroying that horse!"
Can't ye have any respect for the dead? Go easy with that poor horse.
The stableman says,
For the love of Jesus, what are ye squawking about? 'Tis only a dead horse.
And Michael runs at him again with his head down and his small fist flying till the stableman gives him a shove that sends him on his back. And Mam goes at the stableman in such a rage, he runs up the planks and over Finn's body to escape. He comes back drunk in the evening to sleep it off. And after he leaves, there's a smouldering in the hay, and the stable burns down, the rats running up the lane with every boy and dog chasing them till they escape into the streets of respectable people.
Mam says, Alfie is enough, I'm worn out, that's the end of it, no more children. Dad says, The good Catholic woman must perform her wifely duties and submit to her husband or face eternal damnation. Mam says, As long as there are no more children, eternal damnation sounds attractive enough to me. What is Dad to do? There's a war on. English agents are recruiting Irishmen to work in their munitions factories. The pay is good. There are no jobs in Ireland. And if the wife turns her back to you, there's no shortage of women in England, where the able men are off fighting Hitler and Mussolini, and you can do anything you like as long as you remember you're Irish and lower class and don't try to rise above your station. Families up and down the lane are getting telegram money orders from their fathers in England. They rush to the post office to cash the money orders so they can shop and show the world their good fortune on Saturday night and Sunday morning. The boys get their hair cut on Saturdays. The women curl their hair with iron tongs hot from the fire. They're very grand now, the way they pay sixpence, or even a shilling, for seats at the Savoy Cinema, where you'll meet a better class of people than the lower classes who fill the tuppenny seats and the gods at the Lyric Cinema, and are never done shouting at the screen. The kind of people, if you don't mind, who are liable to cheer on the Africans when they throw spears at Tarzan, or the Indians when they're scalping the United States cavalry. The new rich people go home after Mass on Sundays, all airs, and stuff themselves with meat and potatoes, sweets and cakes galore, and they think nothing of drinking their tea from delicate little cups which stand in saucers to catch the tea that overflows. And when they lift the cups, they stick out their little fingers to show how refined they are. Some stop going to fish and chip shops altogether, because you've seen nothing in those places but drunken soldiers and night girls and men that drank their dole and their wives screeching at them to come home. The brave new rich will be seen at the Savoy restaurant or the Stella, drinking tea, eating little buns, patting their lips with serviettes if you don't mind, coming home on the bus and complaining the service is not what it used to be. They have electricity now, so they can see things they never saw before. And when darkness falls, they turn on the new wireless to hear how the war is going. They thank God for Hitler, because if he hadn't marched all over Europe, the men of Ireland would still be at home scratching their arses on the queue at the labour exchange. Some families sing, Yippee-yi-di-yi-yi-yo, yippee-yi-di-yi-yi. We don't care about England or France. All we want is the German advance. If there's a chill in the air, they'll turn on the electric fire for the comfort that's in it and sit in their kitchens listening to the news, declaring how sorry they are for the English women and children dying under the German bombs. But look what England did to us for 800 years. The families with fathers in England are able to lord it over the families that don't. At dinner time and tea time, the new rich mothers stand at their doors and call to their children,
Mikey, Kathleen, Paddy, come in for your dinner. Come in for the lovely leg of lamb and the gorgeous green peas and the flowery white potatoes. Sean, Josie, Peggy, come in for your tea. Come in at once for the fresh bread and butter and the gorgeous blue duck egg, what no one else in the lane have. Brendan, Annie, Patsy,
Come in for the fried black pudding, the sizzling sausages, and the lovely trifle soaked in the best of Spanish sherry.
At times like this, Mam tells us stay inside. We have nothing but bread and tea, and she doesn't want the tormenting neighbors to see us with our tongues hanging out, suffering over the lovely smells floating up and down the lane. She says